We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're so excited to be joined once again by the one and only Todd Bentzman, who is out with a new book. It's called Overrun: How Joe Biden Unleashed the Greatest Border Crisis in U.S. History. I've been really looking forward to digging into this book. Todd, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Let's just break down what's in your subtitle right there, because you have 2 points. One, greatest immigration, greatest border crisis in U.S. history, and two, Joe Biden causing that. So how do we know, first of all, that this really is the greatest border crisis in U.S. history? A lot of people will think back to the waves of migrations, whether it's in the 19th migration, whether in the 19th century, the earlier 20th century. And obviously, there are huge differences that you're very familiar with in the process between then and now. But what do the numbers tell us about this particular wave of illegal crossings at our border?
Right. Well, if you believe the government statistics, and they're really all we have, so yes, we are in territory that we've never been in before in the history. Well, at least since we've been keeping numbers. 1960, Eisenhower started keeping numbers on border apprehensions, and by far, you know, we are, you know, and I don't mean, you know, a little bit by far. I mean, like in the millions, by far, we have had the greatest number of apprehensions at the border. We're looking at about 4.5 million times that Border Patrol has laid hands on immigrants. And then, and a great number of those have been allowed in to the country, something on the order of 2.7 million have actually been allowed to be admitted into the country, which is why we have the problem. And then there's probably another 1.2 to 1.6 million gotaways on top of that. That is formal government nomenclature for, believe it or not, gotaways is a government term. People that got through into the interior. And that's usually an undercount. There's usually far more. Everybody acknowledges that's like the low end. So this is, by all measures, by every measure, the greatest border crisis of illegal immigrants that we've ever had, by far. And that's what I mean by greatest border crisis. What I mean by Joe Biden causing it is that through reporting, just good old-fashioned gumshoe reporting, we can literally trace the start of it to inauguration day, January 20, 2021, because as I report in the book, the Mexican government had been staggering under Trump's pushbacks, the Remain in Mexico pushbacks, the Title 42 pushbacks of families, especially with young children that require high maintenance and expensive, you know, specialized foods and medical attention and everything else, all over Mexico. They were keeping them in Mexican detention centers and Mexican camps, and all during the Trump years, and they were just bridling over this. And it was an absolute mess for the Mexicans. This was terrible under Trump. And so they see the election coming, the American election coming, and the polls were showing Biden was going to win. We all remember that. And so the Mexicans wrote a law for the possibility that Biden would win. And this law would have the effect of emptying out all of their detention centers and making it illegal for Mexico to hold family units. And within 72 hours of confirming Biden had been elected, the Mexican Congress passed that law. This was written by the Mexican president's party and NGOs, including international ones with American ties, wrote this law. And they put a timer in it that covered the transition period between Trump and Biden so that it would implement 10 days before Trump left office and he could do nothing about it. And on that day, they flooded to the American border 10 days before Trump and waited for Inauguration Day. And on Inauguration Day, the Trump administration announced a huge exemption for Title 42 pushback for children with families and unaccompanied minors. And they flooded in that day and every day after. And I was there too. A week later, I was watching this. They were getting on buses. They had conveyor belt system, well-oiled, moving people into the interior of the country, and it never let up. So that's why we can trace it to that day. There's also good reporting, showing that, you know, on that day, they made exemptions for unaccompanied minors, which set off this incredible historic crisis of unaccompanied minors. And for pregnant women, 7 months out, also pouring through that border.
I'm glad you mentioned the conveyor belt language specifically, because as we're recording this, the New York Times recently released audio of Javier Becerra, the head of HHS, talking about how to his employees, Henry Ford would be ashamed of the assembly line that they have going when it comes to getting people in and out of detention facilities. And this was on the heels, or actually maybe included in, a long New York Times expose on migrant children working illegally in factories around the country in violation of child labor laws, because they've been told that if they come to the United States, they sort of get hooked into, via their sponsors in their family or outside of their family, these networks that allow them to get hired, allow them to work at meat processing facilities or something to that extent. They can pay off cartel debts. They can send money back to their families. And Todd, you obviously have already seen all of this and heard all of this from the many migrants you've spoken to over the years, but can you explain to us what's going on here? Why you have Javier Becerra wanting to have a Ford-style assembly line in and out of these detention facilities, and then as those unaccompanied minors come out of the detention facilities, they're ending up employed illegally in factories around the country?
Right. Well, keep in mind that a very far left fringe of the Democratic Party coalition holds to an ideology that there should be no obstruction at any border, that immigrants and people have an inalienable human right to travel wherever they want, whenever they want. And they believe this, and they gain power in this White House and at the State Department and at all the DHS agencies, and have taken great pains to implement that vision. And that vision includes unaccompanied minors. It includes families. It includes pretty much everybody. We're about to see, more than just unaccompanied minors come through, but like all nationalities are now being rechanneled in under this ad hoc. They just created out of whole cloth a new admission system that will be bringing in millions of people. But what happened with the unaccompanied minors is that they said right on the first day, we will not turn any unaccompanied minor back, and we will make bed space available with 3 square meals a day, medical attention, education, dentistry, and we will be a travel agent for you while you're waiting it out in HHS, with us tracking down relatives, and then we will pay for your transportation by air to anywhere in the country you want to go. Well, this is just like too good to be. I mean, they're just giving away to the entire world these incredibly generous travel packages with full care under government custody. And that is what caused the unaccompanied minors crisis. Up until 2013, there were so few unaccompanied minors crossing that the government didn't even keep track. Now we're at 350,000 that have crossed in like 2 years. So it's because of those policies that that we are seeing these children cross through in such huge numbers. And so it stands to reason that there would be abuses. One of the abuses is, I mean, there are many abuses and many more to come. You have not even seen the half of it yet. What you're talking about is labor trafficking and labor exploitation, but they're so eager to move these unaccompanied minors out of government facilities that they are not vetting the foster families that they're placing them with, or the relatives, or whoever they're giving them to. They're not doing home visits. They're doing none of that. So when that Biden administration official made public comments like, we got to move them out even faster, what I hear is sex abuse, labor abuse, physical abuse, and you haven't even begun to see the half of it. For the next 10 years, we are going to be seeing revelation after revelation of terrible harms committed against these children as a result of the hastiness with which they are moving them through. The labor exploitation that we're seeing right now is the tip of the iceberg. It was predicted, it was predictable and predicted, and so will be all the sex abuse and molestation that is going to be coming out next.
And that's one part of the New York Times story, which, again, if you follow this issue closely and you really read real journalism like yours on immigration, you already knew that we are having a very hard time. In some cases, it almost looks intentional, keeping track of people who come here as unaccompanied minors or even as adults, make asylum claims, and then blend into the shadows of sanctuary cities or something like that and live in the shadows of the United States for years on end with no real real definitive timeline as to citizenship or anything like that. And so, Tada, you write about asylum fraud in your book and the vast scope of asylum fraud. Most people coming now, they're turning themselves in. Do most of the people who turn themselves in make asylum claims? Is that what's contributing to asylum fraud? What are we looking at right now in terms of people who are showing up at the border, turning themselves in, maybe going to these detention facilities if they're unaccompanied minors? Basically, my broad question is, what do the legal claims look like as the tens of thousands of people every month are pouring in?
Right. Well, one thing that really distinguishes this particular mass migration event is that all norms are broken. And one of the norms is that you cross the border and then you say, I want asylum, and you go through a credible fear interview. And if the answer is yes, you come in and you wait in line for your court hearing. But in this one, the government has determined has put a presumption that they're all going to claim asylum at some point in the next year or two. They're not even claiming asylum. There's too many flooding across. They can't adjudicate. They can't do the credible fear claims. They're too swamped. They've been crushed, broken system. And so they're handing out notice to appear in a year or two in the interior, on the honor system, kind of a pinky shake thing. Please turn yourself in a year to your nearest ICE office and take care of your asylum stuff or whatever you're going to do.
And they're checking in with WhatsApp, right? Like they have to like take a picture or something in some cases.
Well, that's the latest iteration. But yes, they're granting them access under something called humanitarian parole. If you cross illegally, they give you a humanitarian parole. It's a temporary thing. Go into the interior and one day apply for asylum. And now they've just kind of systematized it in a new way where you can apply in advance of crossing the border, and then you get an appointment to cross with permission through ports of entry. It's a humanitarian, they're still not doing asylum under that. It's still like, you could go check in a couple of years or something with your ICE office. So the asylum is presumed by the government that they're all going to be asylum, which is absurd. I mean, nothing like that has ever happened before. They've always been able to at least claim asylum and do credible fear adjudications. They have a new rule where they're going to let like frontline center CIS officers do the adjudications instead of judges. And there's litigation about that. I mean, they're just breaking all the rules, all the laws, everything. And they're coming up with brand new systems that have never been in place before to just let the bottom line is at the end of it, everybody gets in. And whether they apply for asylum later, win, lose, draw, or abandon is beside the point. They're in forever. Nobody's leaving. They're like, come and get me. And we ended deportation from the interior. We abolished ICE. So they have nothing to worry about under this administration. Every single law, every single rule, every normal practice, every statutory requirement has just been broken and cast aside.
You must start taking care of your liver now more than ever. Why? Well, because the latest data from the American Heart Association indicates that adults with fatty liver were 3.5 times more likely to have heart failure than those without. The American Liver Foundation says that 100 million Americans have fatty liver, which means many people are at risk. We throw everything at our livers: cholesterol, alcohol, toxins, Tylenol, statins, cigarettes. That's why so many of us have a sluggish fatty liver that makes us gain weight and lose energy. For decades now, your liver helped you with over 500 key functions every day. It's time you help your liver. There is a solution: Liver Health Formula, an all-natural supplement which contains 12 clinically proven botanicals that help recharge and protect your liver. Manufactured right here in the USA and approved by American doctors. You can try Liver Health Formula and receive 5 free gifts when you order today. First, you'll receive a free bottle of nano-powered omega-3 to keep your heart healthy. You're also getting 4 free ebooks to support every aspect of your health. Try Liver Health Formula by going to getliverhelp.com/federalist and claim your 5 free bonus gifts. That's getliverhelp.com/federalist. And what does that tell us about how the next several years might unfold, just based on, not even based on future migrants, but based on the migrants that have come in the last 2 or so years and are in the country? We saw this happen during the Obama administration. We have still using DACA migrants as political footballs because of Obama's sort of lawless approach to that. When you say we've abolished ICE, can you break down a little bit what that means, you know, the sort of de facto abolishing of ICE, and then explain a little bit about what we can expect based on history as sort of our guide to happen to these tens of thousands of migrants who are now all over the country with no real impetus to show back up because, you know, they would have to go through the credible fear interview, and it's probably much easier to just stick around and hope they can be somewhere where they don't get deported or arrested. How is this going to unfold over the next several years?
Sure. Well, this administration has decided that deportation is a violation of human rights. So of any kind, of every kind from the interior. And so, you know, on day one, you know, the president implemented in one of the executive orders, like 300 went out on immigration within the first week. And one of the first ones was that we will have a 100-day renewable moratorium on all deportations from the United States. Well, that didn't last long. It was challenged legally and immediately thrown out for exactly what it is, which is illegal. You can't not deport people. It's the law. But they came back around with a plan B, which was to change the internal rules for ICE, ERO, the detention and removal officer corps, about 6,000 across the country, that very, very sharply curtailed what kind of immigrants they could remove. And that did not include anybody with lawful judges' removal orders on them. It didn't matter if you had you had to be like maybe a terrorist or somebody like maybe a serial killer. And even then, you had to call ICE headquarters and get special permission to go run that criminal down or to remove anybody. So it had the effect of handcuffing the 6,000 ICE officers to their desks. They were doing nothing. They're still doing nothing. The number of deportations plummeted by 80%, 90% in some precincts. And then they created also safe zones. There's a long list. There's like 22 or 23 kinds of safe zones where no ICE officer may tread. And so, you know, when you take it all together, there's like very, very few actual deportations happening. And even criminal aliens are left alone when they get out of jails. We don't want to know that they got out of prison for their molestation conviction or their murder. And so those people get to stay. All categories get to stay inside the country. It's a absolutely, you know, nothing like this has ever happened. I mean, no government has ever done this to the American people. It's stupefying, really.
One thing I think that gets lost is the importance of sanctuary cities as a pull factor here. And it got a good amount of attention when you had what was Martha's Vineyard, like designated like a sanctuary jurisdiction or something ridiculous like that, when Governor DeSantis sent migrants that way. But also with Eric Adams, with Mayor Muriel Bowser here in Washington, D.C., you know, mayors of sanctuary cities around the country complaining that migrants are being sent their way, despite the fact that sanctuary cities obviously do act as a pull factor. So, Todd, can you tell us from your experience talking to migrants, are they aware of sanctuary cities? Are they aware of the benefits of sanctuary cities? Are they intentionally clustering in sanctuary cities or, like you're saying, no-go zones for ICE? How does that factor into the decisions that they make once they've crossed the border?
I mean, to an extent, they do. They attract to the places where there's the most stuff, right? So, you know, right now, the big thing is New York, because they're housing everybody in these five-star hotels. So, you know, they're taking selfies and sending them back downstream. And so more people are coming to, the more the New Yorkers bestow this generosity on the immigrants that are showing up in their city, the more will come, because they're like, wait, what? They're giving them everything. They give them everything. So they're coming for that. And there's a lifetime intelligence network by cell phone among the entire all along the trail. Everybody is connected to everybody else in some way. So when the immigrants upstream report back on like who's got the stuff, it naturally attracts. It's like a pheromone trail or something, you know, that, you know, they move to where the stuff is. It's just that simple. But it's a little more complicated than that, because some of them will gravitate to cities where there's work, where they can work off book, or where they have relatives already who can help set them up and get them started. But a lot of it is driven by the free stuff. If you go to the City of San Francisco webpage, they've got a whole section on all the free stuff that they're giving, and they've got departments and bank. They're offering banking services where you don't need an ID. And, you know, I mean, every possible thing that you can imagine to get along as an illegal, they openly offer in San Francisco, and everybody knows that. Like, it just spreads around and attracts people.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
They didn't need the Texas governor or the Florida governor to bus a few up there. They were already being bussed. They were bussing themselves by the tens of thousands to New York and Massachusetts and Washington, D.C., and every city in the country already had just tens upon tens of thousands before any of that publicity stuff happened. It's just that nobody paid attention when that was happening on the conveyor belt. Right. The conveyor belt was happening under the wire.
Right. The migrants were paying attention.
Yeah, the migrants were paying, you know, the $150 or whatever, you know, not a big deal.
Mm-hmm. So if we sort of confront the devil's advocate argument that I know the left makes about, you know, they may say the pull factor is less our benevolent policies or our more benevolent policies than, you know, the Trump administration or whatever else, there's a push factor that's more that's more salient here, that these countries have increasingly destabilized. And that's why we're seeing migrants flock to the border over the course of the Biden administration. It doesn't have anything to do with Biden's policies. And if it does, that's a minimal effect compared to the rise of the destabilization of these areas, cartel violence, gang violence, et cetera, et cetera. And Todd, one thing I love about your reporting is that you have actually been not just to Mexico, but to Central America, sort of exploring the situation on the ground there. So what do you say to people who would maybe make that counter argument?
Well, it's undeniable that there are push factors. These are terrible. Nobody wants to live in Haiti. And a lot of people don't want to live in Honduras and some of these other broken countries. I get that. I think we can all kind of get that. But those are steady state conditions. They don't change quickly or over time. And so they are not responsible for daily, weekly, monthly, and annual rushes and retreats of migrants. They're just simply always pushing, and it's like a spigot on your water faucet at home. There's always the pressure, but the water won't come out until you turn the knob. And what's happened here is, if you talk to the immigrants, and I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of them, and at length, in depth, they'll tell you the Biden people turned the knob. That's why we're coming. So that's my response to that. I mean, yeah, there are push factors, but those never changed. Nothing new terrible happened in Haiti. There wasn't some new terrible thing that happened in, or when Trump was in office and they stopped coming, it wasn't that Honduras suddenly fixed its corruption problem, you know, and all of a sudden there's jobs in Honduras. No. The spigot was closed. They weren't going to get their money's worth, their smuggling money's worth. And to me, that's just like really foundational. It's really obvious. I even say in the book, I should not have to say this out loud in a book, but it's not being absorbed that people come when they see the spigot open, when the doors open. And it's really not much more complicated than that. And also, I'll tell you this, that, you know, I have been to some of the places, and you know, in Guatemala, for example, and the Central Highlands, I spent time there on the ground, you know, because the Central Highlands of Guatemala is like a ghost province now. I mean, almost the whole thing is emptied out into the United States on asylum claims. But when you go, they're indigenous peoples. But when you go there and you ask the people that are still there, like, what was the terrible thing happening here? They're like, what terrible thing? There's nothing happening here. We just, nothing. It's fine. I mean, we're poor, but nobody's bothering us from the government, or there's just nothing like that happening here. Mm-hmm. So the Haitians are another great example. The vast majority, I would say the super majority of Haitians that have been entering through our southern border haven't lived in Haiti in years. They've been living in the most powerful economy in Latin America, Chile, the best economy, with work permit, with work authorization, with residency, with cards, children that are citizens and everything else. They were happy there. But they are the ones that started coming to the U.S. border. And when I ask why, they're like, because we can. We couldn't before, but now we can. So we're going to upgrade. There's nothing terrible happening in Chile, nothing. The same goes for the Venezuelans. The vast majority of Venezuelans that are crossing the border have been living for 5, 6, 7, 8 years in Colombia and 5, 6, 7 other countries around Venezuela in prosperity. Venezuelans are notoriously prosperous. When they come across, they're carrying Gucci bags. But it's like, well, Colombia is fine. We've got a good business here, but the door's open. Let's go.
Mm. Mm. You've had some dicey situations in your travels through Central America, Mexico, as you document in Overrun. There's one in particular. I think you're on the border of Costa Rica and Nicaragua. Can you tell us about that, Todd, and maybe some other just examples of what you've seen in Central America and what it's like to be an American reporter on the ground?
Well, yeah. So, you know, when you go down, when you go into these territories, you know, there are, some of them are pretty lawless. You know, there are criminal elements, and if you're not careful, you know, you can kind of cross the wrong group of people, or, you know, catch the wrong kind of attention. And so, you know, there have been some incidents. You know, I don't want to belabor because this is not really about me so much, but if you're trying to tell the story, you can run into some trouble. And there was an incident in Costa Rica on the border there where I was reporting on the international flow of migrants coming through that area right there at the border. And there's no reporters ever been there before. So they're not worried. Nobody knows what a reporter is. It's like, you know, completely virgin territory. And so I found that I could just hang out with all the smugglers every day, and I got to be friendly with them, and eventually convinced a couple of them to let me follow their loads up to the border. They're Haitians or Mauritanians or whatever it was. And there was a smuggling town off the books up there called La Trocha. And nobody ever goes there. This is controlled by two criminal gangs. And I convinced a smuggling woman to let me follow a load into that place. And when I got there, you know, she put me and the Haitians over in this house and then left for a while and came back and said, there's a problem. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. And she's like, I shouldn't have brought you here. And I said, I'm so sorry. I don't want to get you in trouble with these guys. She's like, no, it's not me I'm worried about. It's you. They're right now over there having a big meeting about what to do with you. So if I were you, I would leave. You should leave right away before they get finished with that meeting. And so, you know, we had to flee this town before, you know, wondering if they had made their decision and were going to come after us or whatever. And on another occasion, I followed a different smuggler up to the border to drop his load off to corrupt Nicaraguan soldiers who came out of the jungle, and we did the handoff. But the smugglers back in town didn't appreciate that I had seen this, and they issued a very explicit death threat as I was driving back, accosted me and my translator, and the smuggler too, who happened to be with me. And we just had to flee the town immediately with, you know, everything we could grab from the hotel room. And there have been some other things like that. But for the most part, you know, if you just play your cards right and do, you know, risk reductions, get in, get your story, don't make a big stink or fuss, and get out, you're going to be fine.
The Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski. Every day, Chris helps unpack the connection between politics and the economy and how it affects your wallet. It's time to embrace the suck. Continually worrying about your investments dipping while the market remains extremely volatile? Pay attention to the companies where your money is located. Is it time to reevaluate your financial decisions or just continue to embrace the suck? Whether it's happening in D.C. or down on Wall Street, it's affecting you financially. Be informed. Check out the Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, it's interesting how much experience you've had and how much access you've had into the kind of the supply chain, almost, the way that it goes. I mean, it's just such a Becerra-esque way to think about it, but it's certainly how the cartels think about it. When you're in Central America, so say Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, are you dealing with cartels or are you dealing with local gangs? Are they the ones that are sort of smuggling people up to the Mexican border? Are they working with cartels? Are they affiliated with cartels? What is the, denomination of those different organizations?
Right. It's different. Each area of the border is different from every other, is unique from every other area. So Remember, I was telling you about runners. There are areas of the border that just specialize in runners. And then there are other areas where there are give-ups. Tens of thousands of people cross in and they just wait and give up. In both cases, cartels are involved. They got to pay. But I try to avoid the cartels or any of their people at all costs. That's just a thing. It's a personal code. I did run into one. I described this encounter in the book, in the introduction of the book, where I met by accident a smuggling guide who was just back from one of his trips. He was La Linea. And I ran into him under the bridge, the international bridge in Ojinaga, Mexico. And he was the first one who told me, this is all Biden doing this. I'm getting rich on Joe Biden. And he called it the La Invitacion. This was the word he gave me. I was like, because he was snorting coke. He had cocaine. He had these prostitutes with him. And he was partying with a couple of friends and had all this money. And what do you owe, you know, all this prosperity? And he says, La Invitacion. And when we dug into it, he said that it was the moratorium, initially the moratorium on deportations, that had caused this incredible boom in Guatemalan, Honduran, Salvadoran runners. And you can't interview the migrants in those areas because the cartels have them under lock and key in stash houses. And in that town, I spotted seven or eight, I think they were Guatemalans carrying backpacks, and I pulled over and tried to talk to them. And they said, okay, yeah, we'll talk to you. And you know, I pulled in and parked, and the next thing I know, I look up and they're just like sprinting as fast as they could the other way to get away. So it's very difficult to interview those people. However, I was able to, some of them got 42'd back into Ojinaga with nothing, not even their shoelaces, right out of Border Patrol. They got caught. And I was able to interview nine of them at great length about how the whole thing works. That's in the book. About how the cartels work on the runners, moving runners through, which is a major part of this crisis. And then the other part is just the give-ups. Those are the easy ones where you have the Fox News drones floating over the, you know, 3,000 of them, you know, they just give up. And those are, you can go and talk to them. And on the other side, you can find the cartels. I don't want to interview them usually, but recently, I was able to do a story on Piedras Negras, where I was able to interview the Mexican immigration officers and local journalists and local people about what was going on over there. And in that area, the state police are the cartel, including the director of the state police, and everybody else are moving these thousands and thousands through at $400 a head. So I won't be going to Piedras Negras for about 6 months after that piece.
Yeah, that sounds like a wise choice, Todd. I wanted to ask about the so-called pink wave that people have said is sort of sweeping Latin America. Obviously, they'll point to AMLO and Lula and look at, you know, different places, Argentina. What is the kind of relationship between... This is a big, complicated question, I know, but is there a relationship between the fact that, as you say, there are parts of, for instance, Guatemala that have just been hollowed out by American asylum claims? Is this destabilizing some of, like, is the migration wave adding to the destabilization of some countries that might already be unstable because it's just hollowing out their communities? And is that affecting the politics of Latin America right now?
Yeah, that is a really big question. I'll be honest. I really haven't studied the correlation of that. It's not in the book between, you know, what's happening with the governments. Some of this is relatively new, and it would fall into the category of push factors. And I'm not a big fan of the push factor idea. I do believe that, you know, we started seeing a lot of Peruvians, for example, you know, some months ago, hundreds of them pouring over the border. because, you know, they had a change in government there, and there were gas price riots and food price riots, and things had gotten more difficult for them. In ordinary times, they would have just gone to a neighboring country and sat it out or not gone anywhere. But they're like, borders open in the U.S., let's go for it. So, I mean, I think to some extent that makes people decide, well, the border's open, let's go for it. And, you know, the Venezuelans are, I mentioned earlier, are not coming from Venezuela directly. They're safe and sound in a lot of the neighboring countries. But, you know, they could have come during Trump, but why spend $10,000 in smuggling money when you're just going to end up in Mexico?
Right.
Nobody comes for the great Mexican dream.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, can you break down for us why someone would choose to be a known gotaway? Obviously, they're not saying I'm going to go to the border and be a known gotaway, but why someone right now would choose to cross illegally as opposed to turning themselves in and making a false asylum claim or fraudulent asylum claim? What's the sort of difference in the tactic? Why right now, if the border is kind of de facto open because of this Byzantine system of policies involving humanitarian parole and something else, what's the kind of benefit then of crossing illegally?
Two main things, and they go to the heart of the Byzantine-ness of the system. For the first 2 years, remember that the Biden administration kind of selected the chosen for exemption from Title 42. So they were the chosen. If you were a family group with kids under seven, you got in. Automatic, guaranteed, you're in. If you were an unaccompanied minor, guaranteed in. If you were from certain countries that we couldn't readily deport you, you were in. But then there were these other nationalities that were the unchosen. And you could go into a Mexican city and just see the streets filled with these desultory unchosen who are all upset because everybody else that were on the chosen got to go right in and they couldn't go in. So those people became runners because all they had to do was to get 100 miles past Border Patrol, and they were in the deportation-free zone. So there was this powerful push-pull thing that channeled people to run, that made people want to run. The other thing is that that pool of runners has a high concentration of criminality. If you have been in the United States and got deported and because you got in trouble, you have a criminal record and we catch you, we will put you back in Mexico. And a large, I cannot tell you how many I've met over and over and over again, wherever I went, anywhere down there, would be these guys that spoke perfect English. And I'm like, where'd you get your English? Oh, I lived for 10 years in South Carolina. And I'm like, oh, you got in trouble. He goes, yeah. Yeah, I got in trouble. I was framed, but whatever. After their prison sentences, they get deported. And so they're coming back because they sense the border is open to them. All they have to do is get through that 100-mile mark, and they're back with their friends, their families, and nobody's going to come after them. So that pool has a high concentration of criminality in it, ex-cons and that sort of thing. People that would be turned back for, they're on the database, they're a gang member, they're whatever, and they know it. So that those are the two categories of people that make up the runners. That's why those are running.
Mm. Oh, it's so interesting. Before we run, Todd, is there anything else you think people should know that maybe they don't know about how this whole system works? Maybe something the media gets really wrong, and the long list of things you point out the media gets wrong. But overall, is there something big that people are missing?
Here's a thing that, I didn't get into this when we were talking about the unaccompanied minors, but that for the first 2 years of this thing, remember that the Biden administration had anointed as the chosen families with kids seven and under. And then they anointed unaccompanied minors who were under 18. So what if you're a family with a couple of six-year-olds and a 13-year-old. The whole family gets pushed back into Mexico because of the 13-year-old. They can't get in together. So they have been self-separating by the tens of thousands in order to send the unaccompanied 13-year-old in by themselves. They get in, and then they come in with the younger kid, and then they get in and they all hook up later. And this has been happening. There's a the unaccompanied minor crisis. Like there's a narrative out there that, you know, there are all these like kind of wandering orphan waifs that are just like making it for freedom and they're all alone. And that's like this political mythology of the unaccompanied minor. But the reality is that their parents are just like a couple miles away. They've self-separated. There's good reporting on this. CBS actually, or NBC, I think, one of them, it's in my book. One of the networks did a great piece. They got somebody leaked them a bunch of internal DHS documents showing thousands and thousands of families had done the self-separation thing. They couldn't get in with the older kid. So they sent the older kid in as an unaccompanied minor and went in on their own. The gaming of the systems is so widespread and so diverse. We are such fools. We are such like idiots in our immigration policy. And everybody down there knows how to game the system within a week or 2 weeks of whatever policy change. They're figuring out how to defraud it and get in. And we're none the wiser. Or if we are the wiser, we don't care because we just want them all in because they're far liberal fringe people of a strange ideology that got into power.
And it's a very patronizing sort of perspective on the agency of these migrants as well.
Yeah. I mean, well, they're really smart. For whatever their lack of formal education and, you know, whatever, man, they're smart people. I enjoy talking to them. They get it. They understand what's happening. A month or two ago, I was in Monterrey, Mexico, at the bus station there, and I met a 25-year-old Venezuelan, and I was interviewing him, and then all of a sudden, he started going into the credible U.S. credible fear interview process. And he knew all about it, and I'm like, what? Wait, hold on. And I just started letting him roll, you know, about, oh, yeah, and if you say this, then you won't get in, but if you say that, you will get in, and so we're going to say that, and we're going to get in, and I mean, they
it's
know
like jury duty.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, the book is called Overrun: How Joe Biden Unleashed the Greatest Border Crisis in U.S. History. Todd Bensman is with the Center for Immigration Studies. I am an avid reader of Todd's newsletter. You should absolutely sign up for it. I read every edition. You can do that at toddbensman.com. Such a fantastic book, such a fantastic piece of reporting. Todd, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason, and then it faded away.